the panic that the millennium bug generated? Almost said degenerated. People worried that computers would crash and food would run out and there'd be mayhem. But now we know it didn't cause the end of the world. The future, but more particularly what we don't know about the future, is a strong theme in Stephen Amsterdam's debut collection of short stories. It's called Things We Didn't See Coming. In this book, there are floods, fires, political unrest, chaos, looting, pandemics. Sounds familiar. The common thread that links these stories is the dystopian futuristic setting and the narrator. The book show's Sarah Lestrange spoke to Stephen Amsterdam about things we didn't see coming, and he starts by describing the narrator in this book.
He's an artful dodger. That's what I came up with only after writing it and after reading it. But he's someone who manages to kind of squirrel through the sides of life a little bit. He doesn't really barrel forward like a confident narrator. He's more on the edges, more a little bit opportunistic and sometimes sneaky and conniving, but hopefully a little bit sympathetic.
Things We Didn't See Coming is a futuristic story that has a lot of resemblance to the present and our current fears about infectious disease and global warming. Perhaps the narrator needs to be artful in this dystopian, decayed world.
It's a survival thing. It's a survival thing without being, you know, I suppose your options are Mad Max or just dying. So for the average guy who I suppose I identify with him a bit, I imagine I'd tend more towards the artful.
Yes, well, he's not a Mad Max. There's nothing particularly amazing or astounding about him. He's just a normal guy.
Scrawny.
A scrawny guy in a pretty unpleasant future. Can you describe the sort of person he is when we meet him in the first chapter?
He's either a precocious 9 or 10, and he's impressionable. He's a little bit in love with his father at that point, and already a little bit sneaky. He's trying to figure out his place in things, because his parents are, there's a little bit of discord going on, and his father's quite wound up about the millennium, and he's packing and they're getting ready to go and kind of run away to the woods, and the mother's going along politely, but she's not buying it. So the son is trying to be the little bit of an intermediary, but I think he's leaning with his father's view that the world is going to come to a crashing halt at midnight.
It goes back to the 1970s and a computer language called COBOL. Programmers used the numbers 9999 to show certain tasks were finished. No one then thought about future date problems.
I'm stocking up on ammunition because I don't want no one breaking into my house. I don't want no looters. I want trying to keep my family safe.
The CIA has revealed that it's worried the computer bug could produce a humanitarian disaster in unprepared or poorly prepared countries. And the US intelligence agency says it's not just...
This is AM. I'm Peter Cave. Welcome to the year 2000. The millennium bug appears to have given Australia a wide berth, or its financial system, so far at least. And as Steve said,
of course, we know now that the apocalypse didn't occur when the clock ticked over to the year 2000, but there was a lot of concern at the time. In terms of bleakness, Stephen Amsterdam's book can be compared to Cormac McCarthy's The Road, although there's no direct influence, as Stephen told me he hadn't read this book. Like The Road, in Things We Didn't See Coming, there's a mystery about the events that have caused the social meltdown that the characters are struggling to survive.
It was certainly meant to invoke the millennium and all the fears around the millennium, but I think at the same time to point out that this was something we were incredibly worried about that did not come to pass. So as far as the cosmos of the whole book, it's strange. I mean, obviously the stories are connected and linear, but it's almost like it's a variation on the millennium thing. There's not one complete narrative for the background of the book.
Now, at one point, your characters are watching RoboCop, the movie. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of this?
The narrator and his sometimes lady friend, Margot, are sitting in a limousine watching RoboCop on a screen in a large limousine. And they get to the point where the narrator is looking back at some of the things that are kind of predicted in RoboCop, which is a futuristic movie from, I believe, the 80s. And he's looking at the concerns of that movie and what they predicted for the future, and he's laughing at it, and probably a little bit laughing at us in the present, that we don't know anything either.
We get the best of both worlds. The fastest reflexes modern technology has to offer, onboard computer-assisted memory, and a lifetime of on-the-street law enforcement programming. It is my great pleasure to present to you RoboCop.
What's the link then between RoboCop and the title of this collection, Things We Didn't See Coming?
It's more of the irony of the inability to know the future. And that's what plagues the narrator. That's what plagues us at the moment, or at every moment, and all of us. So things we didn't see coming, and you know, the question that get asked was what are the things we didn't see coming? And obviously we don't know.
And so there's more of a focus on how the narrator gets by in this unsafe, uncertain world.
I was interested in the personal element of it. All the chaos of the politics, or the chaos of the weather, or whatever else, becomes kind of incidental. I can think of September 11th. I was in New York, and all I wanted, I was standing on the roof watching it, and all I wanted was breakfast. And it was such a strange response, and the person I was with reminds me of it from time to time. But you go into the very small things, and I think that this character gets sucked into that as well. That what's going to help him is not overcoming the weather or overcoming the plague. It's whatever's going to help him in the closest sense of his world.
In later stories, he has a girlfriend who is very independent and will leave him for days. How would you describe his relationship to her?
Complex. My sister said she thought that they were very well suited, and I don't really know what that meant. But I thought that it was actually a fairly terrible relationship, and I feel bad for the guy that I gave that I saddled him with that for the chunk of the book, because it's an on and off thing, and that you definitely get the feeling that they're not quite hearing each other, but they're keeping each other company during hard times. And it's
so, is it a matter of survival that he has someone to latch on to, even if that someone actually isn't very good for him?
I think they care about each other at different moments and in different ways, but I don't think they see each other as real people very well.
Different dystopian futures are canvassed in this book. The government has collapsed. There's a pandemic. There's social decay. Stealing is the norm. Even grandparents steal to survive. One story is set in the desert, where the narrator and his girlfriend have set up camp to avoid a flu-like disease. And there's also a story about a breakaway commune in which the narrator lived as a chaperone for the last surviving child in the group. And in another scenario called Dry Land, it's raining constantly. Here's Stephen Amsterdam reading from the beginning of this chapter in his book.
A rain horse is a horse that's been sensitized to travel in downpours without complaint. It can carry packs and people through rising water at a trot. I've never asked who trains them or how, but I'm grateful. This mare never checks me, as long as she's got her hood and body cover on. She'll step through rotten logs in the forest, cross rushing water down main streets to get where we need to get. She's absolutely bombproof when it comes to thunder or avoiding the deer when they run, and that you can't teach. She was born sound and knows it. I keep the contact secure but easy. She follows, keeping pace as we slop through what's left of the few paths along the hillsides and through miles of flooded farmland. On the other hand, I was never trained to travel in these long downpours, and I'm tired of the damp. But I've got a lot of autonomy. I'm supposed to cover the low areas, look for the shaky light of candles burning in dark houses, and evacuate whoever's still thinking that the sky's about to clear. Land management sends me in to protect them from starvation and flooding. Also, my job is to make sure no one gets hurt when the animals on the land nearby finally get so desperate that they come stampeding through. I'm clearing people so the animals can push through the empty suburbs and muddy farms to find higher ground. Truth is, the people part of the job isn't so great. I do the social work. I give them the government warning and the pitiable vouchers for relocation. I give them all the good reasons to abandon their homes. The men all tell me I shouldn't be doing this job. The women are mostly polite. The children gape at me like I'm the boogeyman. Some guys who come out on these gigs are full of compassion for the human suffering and want to help the families come to terms, deal with their loss, adjust. They stay a night or two to help pack. They get involved. it's a noble call if you see it like that, but all I see is people being washed away by life, and I think the respectful thing to do is treat them efficiently, not ask them how it feels. I like to go in, say what I've got to say, hand out the extra meds against rheumatism, and ride on to an empty house to camp for the night. A good third of the time, they take it out on me anyway. They curse me, call me everything they'd like to call the rain. They act like they're going to shoot me. But they're just broken, and no one makes good on those threats, at least not against a government employee. Let's face it, nobody takes this job for the salary. You're on your own all day long with just the sound of rain. When it gets too much, I make the times pass by conjuring sunny days, warm meals, people who are happy to see me. That works all right till it's time for dinner and bed. The real reward is having the pick of abandoned property and then hauling away whatever the horse can carry. There are some nice houses out here, and making yourself comfortable in a mansion for a night isn't so bad either, even in the rain. Land management keeps looking the other way as long as we clear out the stragglers. They put us on horses to keep us from carrying away too much of the take. They say it saves on fuel, but this way they've got to provide the mayor as well as me with enough meds to stay functional. A jeep would be cheaper and faster. The government trucks are a few days behind us, harvesting the bigger prizes. Basically, all the construction material that isn't soaked through. My haul is better if I scour the high roads and pretend not to notice all those little worried lights in the valley.
Stephen Amsterdam, reading from his debut book, Things We Didn't See Coming. The titles of the stories in this book include The Forest for the Trees, The Profit Motive, The Theft That Got Me Here, and What We Know Now. There's a solid narrative thread that runs through this book, which I read as a collection of connected short stories. How did Stephen write it?
Well, I wrote the second chapter or story I wrote first, and then things kind of spiraled out from that one. And so I had the narrator at about, I think, 17 there. And then I wrote the last chapter of the book where he's about 39 or 40. And then I was able to kind of fill in blanks and imagine a life for this guy in between. So as I was writing it, I was conscious of the fact that I was telling a larger story, possibly novelistically, but I was also aware that I was sending these stories out for publication on their own and trying to make them work on their own. And I think the book kind of profits from that jump between each story. So things aren't completely tied up at the end of each story, but they're also they do move you along. So I get the benefit of telling a large story and also the benefit of telling some small stories, and I think people digest small stories better and they kind of can pick highlights in a person's life that way.
So you wrote these like short stories?
Definitely. I thought of each one as almost in a few acts each. I kind of come up with about five points that I want to get to and five kind of beats in the story, and really thinking of them quite individually as I was working on them. And it was only as I had enough of them that I started really thinking of hanging them all together and putting together a large outline that would sit someplace on my computer and I would refer to from time to time, but mostly it was what's the next story.
Throughout this book, the narrator is never named, and the events take place in an undefined location. I was curious why Stephen had chosen this tactic for the stories in his book, Things We Didn't See Coming.
The narrator's name is always a problem for me, because if you name him Scott, there it is, he's Scott. It's just not that exciting to me. And so I felt like by just having it be I, people don't really call you by your name that often in regular dialogue, so why should they do it in the book? And as it evolved, there was no real reason for him to get a name. And as for place, imagining the future is a strange thing for me, because I don't read a lot of science fiction. I haven't read a lot of dystopia, and I'm kind of unschooled in that whole area. So a little bit of what's dripped into my mind is from the basics, like 1984 and Brave New World and Blade Runner and RoboCop. So I can imagine all those kind of standard places. And I didn't feel like specifying, because I'm American, and I didn't want to make it a wholly American book. I wanted to make it a more about the characters than the place.
What was the attraction then for writing a dystopian futuristic novel?
I didn't know I was doing it at the time. When I wrote The Theft That Got Me Here, the second story, it was a couple of different things I had read or thought about that became the story, and I wasn't thinking apocalypse. I was thinking the grandparents who were getting their licenses taken away. I was thinking about the American election in 2004 that was so completely partisan that and regionally partisan that I could imagine the city people trying to secede from the country people and there being barricades in between. It didn't feel that far into the future. It felt like the animosity was real enough so that I could picture something a little closer to now.
That's American novelist Stephen Amsterdam, who now calls Australia home, speaking to the book show's Sarah Lestrange about his debut book, Things We Didn't See Coming, and it's published by Sleepers. This is the book show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.